Thank you, Eric. Before I introduce the speaker and the topic for this evening, I want to make a couple comments about some information that you were given when you came in. One of the things that you should have in your hand is the program for next time. And you'll notice that next time we're featuring Harold Miller, and we're going to be visiting Africa from about a 50-year perspective. And I think you'll find that to be an enriching time. You also should have received a half sheet of paper that looks a little bit like this. It's an evaluation form. We would be most pleased if you would take time to either fill it out tonight during the time. Don't let your attention wander too far away. And you can leave them on the tables on your way out. Or you can take them home and send them to either Richard or myself via campus mail or postal mail. Let me just explain one thing. You'll notice at the top, we're asking you to rate the following five forum, and these are the ones starting in January of this year through May, Randy Sites. And the response is 4 for excellence, 1 for poor, or 0 did not attend, or for some of us, did not recall. And don't evaluate it if you don't recall. But so for an example, January, Mary Kay Adams, Understanding Dementia, An Appropriate Response, etc. So you'll notice those that are on the line by it, you can put whatever number you think is appropriate. And then there's a space for suggestions for future topics and or presenters. And then finally, some overall suggestions. And if there's not enough room there, you can write on the back. If that's not enough room, you can attach several pages to it and send it to us. And then finally, at the bottom, we have a place for email. If you want to be on our email list, especially if you're outside of the VMRC community, we will try to get that email list up and going, and we use it for publicity. One more thing. Last month when we were here, you received a projection of the upcoming elder forums, and it was a schedule like this through January. We have some of these remaining. If you did not get one when you came in and you lost the one that you had last month, they're on the side tables and you can get them when you exit tonight. I am very pleased to introduce, although he needs little introduction, my fellow comrade, I'm going to use that word, who I coerced to try to do this presentation. Actually, he was previously scheduled a couple times and got bumped. But tonight is the time to look at space travel and Christian faith. Dr. Richard Bowman, retired physics professor from Bridgewater College. And if you noted the bio from last time, and most of you don't have it, you'll notice that he is emeritus from Bridgewater College. That means he didn't get fired, but it means that they liked him when he left. And so they gave him that kind of a title. He was chair of the Department of Physics and involved in academic computing. He received his PhD in biophysics from Oregon State. He and his wife Elsie have 4 married children and 10 grandchildren. I knew Richard more as his role as minister and overseer. He was involved in that in the Virginia Conference. He's also lived foreignly or internationally in Belize and in Albania for a couple years. So, without a whole lot of further ado, I'm going to invite Richard to come forward. We're going to welcome him. And just to give you an up heads up what's going to happen, after he's finished with his presentation, I will introduce 2 respondents who will give their responses to his presentation. And then we will have the floor open for questions and answers from the audience. So if some questions get generated while Richard is talking or when one of the respondents are talking, make sure you note those. So let's welcome Richard.
Thank you. I'm going to try sitting down here. I've had both hips replaced, one of them three times, and my knee is giving out now. They want to, regardless of what my political views are, they want to take a conservative approach. Drum roll when I need it. So I'm going for a brace. The only problem was when I grew up, I thought braces were old-fashioned and only my dad and uncles used them to hold their pants up. Come on, I thought you were, enough of the age to know that. Anyway, it is interesting that this should be the time that this does get put up, this particular program, because back in 50 years ago, this July, all of you should remember where you were when you saw pictures of the person taking the first steps on the moon. You all remember where? Okay. Interestingly enough, tying in with this tonight, I was nearly finished my physics degree at the bachelor's level, and was spending my summer working in voluntary service under the Mennonite Church in Philadelphia and trying to work at some social issues there. At that point, we referred to the area that I was in Philadelphia, we referred to that as the Black Ghetto. I just say that, not, I won't use that today, but just to identify with you where that was. If any of you know the area, it's around Diamond Street near Temple. And so it's interesting that here again, my Christian faith and this academic thing about physics or astronomy come together. So take a couple, look at a couple. Oh, I did put these in the wrong order. Okay, I should have put my pictures. I think I have my pictures. Let's go to my pictures first. Yes. There is the picture of Buzz Aldrin taking the first steps down the ladder. I should have looked it up. I'm not that particular into famous people, quote unquote. I don't know if that was me. I don't. Let's see. I hold it long enough, it turns off. Is that the way it goes? I give it up. Anyway, obviously he was not the first person down the ladder. And why do you know?
Somebody took the picture.
Because the picture's off here, the camera's taken off here somewhere to look back. Come on now, you got to get your education here. All right, thank you, Eugene. I do like that one, and this was in the Apollo 11 that landed. This is from the Apollo 8. This is probably my most favorite picture from all those whole seasons of pictures taken before we had peopled trips around when they were on. I've never found another good word for this that's not gender specific, but I'll just say, when they sent unmanned spacecraft circling the moon before then and crashing into it and things like that. This is still the best ones from Apollo 8. It's the Earthrise. And I think that just is something to me to remember, that not only does our universe surprise us, it also takes me into my faith thing and reminds me that the Holy Spirit surprises us too. Anyway, so that's a little bit of my aside here. So let's go back. I won't go through all these names, but if, in case there was any person young enough, but I don't think there's any children here, that's too bad. Because my interest in physics, I can definitely take back to sixth grade. And when I talk with people who are teaching physics, not, I shouldn't say all of them, and you may respond to me during your response time where your background was. Many of us have started late elementary years, have started with our interest. While if you talk with chemists and biologists, Many of them have gotten their interest in chemistry or biology later on in high school, and some in biology even into college, where they changed majors and became biology. Very few physicists change majors and become a physicist. Many of them, and engineers, will change a major and move out of physics or engineering, but Arlenia will move the other way. So I do want to give Mr. Bowers that credit there. And then some high school teachers of chemistry and math and physics, Larry Wenger from LMH, my senior year I was there, and Stanley Kreider was in math and Larry was in physics. Anyway, I just wanted to identify all of these at EMU here. I think I saw Ruby here this evening. This is in, to give credit to your husband. Bob Lehman was my mentor for most of my 4 years here. John Horst and Joe Mass came as young professors while I was here. And Millard Showalter, I think, had come the year before I came. I came here in 66. So I don't know if Millard is here tonight, if he can tell us.
I came in 66 also.
Oh, so you came the same year. Okay, I couldn't remember which way it was. And then my graduate advisor, Curtis Johnson, and a colleagues, Herbert Kuster at Elizabethtown College, Phil Spickler, and several math and computer science profs at Bridgewater. I know I will miss people, but at the same time, I want to point it out just to show the variety of things and to show something that I believe strongly. The last block of names here, and it's more having to do with roles, has to do with my Christian faith. And I do want to say that I believe strongly that my one's Christian faith and one's academic background can go together as a whole and not as compartmentalized Greeks. I would love to claim that I'm a whole Hebrew, but we'll leave that alone and see where Laura might come in on that. My parents, Leroy and Lydianne, people who finished eighth grade in school, I can't imagine quite how they coped with this son of theirs. But anyway, I appreciate them for at least not ostracizing me. Now, I do want to begin with some math here. And this is the theory of special relativity. In 1905, Albert Einstein had two seminal papers. One of them was on the theory of special relativity. And there were two basic concepts. You'll see them worded in many different kinds of ways. But again, I don't want you getting lost by the math. So don't ask me to repeat something about the math. It's only here for those who are interested and to show that this what does flow from one end to the other. That's my main point for most of you to pick up. Anyway, the idea is here. First one is an inertial frame of reference. That is a frame of reference. Let me put you some down here. Have two inertial frames of reference. One has a zero velocity and one has a fixed velocity v, and they're moving relative to each other, but neither one is accelerating. So we call those inertial frames of reference. And in the one that is moving here, the meter stick is at still in its frame of reference, but the meter stick is moving in the other frame. So I remember, is John Horst here? One of the big things that I enjoyed, there were two of us who were in the first graduating class that had physics majors in it from EMU. It was in 1970. Claire Bang and I graduated. And so John Horst was the one who got knocked about in modern physics when he kept telling us all these things that happened. If you go fast enough, your meter stick will get shorter. If you go fast enough, you'll gain weight. All kinds of things. And of course, we were really good, as a physics professor now, I understand. But if he forgot a square root, we were, Mr. Mass, don't you want a square root there? Yeah, I think I do. Anyway, so sorry about you having to put up with us. Anyway, so first thing is that we can write these laws of physics for any inertial frame. We can write them the same way. Now, They're not going to necessarily look the same, but they will be mathematically equivalent eventually. And then the other one is a very profound one, is that there is no velocity greater than the velocity of a light in a vacuum. And I forget if I put those that on here or not. And that that speed or velocity is a constant that does not vary with the receptor or the source. The source can appear to be moving. It may think I'm moving because it's moving past Jupiter. So the source says I'm moving. Or somebody picking it up could say, well, I'm moving because I'm in a spacecraft. We can't tell. In physics, those as long as you have inertial frames of reference, you cannot tell who's moving with respect to whom. You can only tell that the two are moving with respect to each other. Well, there are several things then that come from this, and I need to get ahead to my pages here. The first one is this length contraction that I've mentioned, and that is if a meter stick went flying past here near the speed of light, it would appear to be maybe, instead of 100 centimeters long, maybe from our point of view, if we held our meter stick up, the one that's flying past us would look 30 centimeters or so. That's called length contraction, it's shrinking up. If we look at the little ant that's traveling on that meter stick, and we know how long ants live on the average, and we watch this poor guy, and he keeps living and living and living until he's on the other end of Heritage Haven, and he should have died by the door here. What happened was his time got dilated so that his clocks, not just mechanical clocks, his biological clocks slowed down relative to what I would see it. Interestingly enough, when that poor ant looked at me, he couldn't understand why I was not appearing older since I was taking so long to stay young. Anyway, and then the relativity of mass or energy, they both follow that same formula. And as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, the mass or energy required to do that approaches infinity. Doesn't get there, but approaches that. Now let's take a look at something to, where did I go? Okay. I want to get to just one evidence. In science, we do not prove things. When you ask if science proves something, you've asked the wrong question. Science never proves anything. It shows the validity for our models. But all we ever have in science are models. I don't care what you call it, it is not truth. It is models of the universe. So to keep that straight. Anyway, so we can verify this, and this is one, the cosmic ray muons. They're created at about 6,000 meters above the surface of the Earth in the upper atmosphere, and yet they reach, I didn't want to do that too badly for you. I do that in my classes when I'm talking about this, and they all, are you okay, Dr. Bowman? Yes, I just was hit by a cosmic ray muon. And it's just really neat that God doesn't have those cosmic ray muons to interact with matter very readily at all. They are zipping through you and I at the rate when we have our detectors on. They are zipping through us at about 100 per square meter per second. And the square meter is in perpendicular to the surface of the Earth. So they are really going through us and sand. So they reach this level. So how do they do that when their average lifetime is only 2.3, you don't see that yet. Let me go to the end of this and then we can talk about it. 2.3 microseconds, that's 10 to the minus, if you're into 10 powers of 10, it's 10 to the minus 9, minus 6, sorry. And yet, so it should die within a short distance of about 600 meters. And yet they are traveling at close to 100% of the speed of light, 99.83% the speed of light. And so if we take a look at that and take a look at the clocks that are running on these muons, we can see that, in fact, we have that 2.3 microseconds actually expands into 38 microseconds. So when we see the muon created at the upper atmospheres and see it reaching Earth, from our point of view, it has 38 microseconds to die, meaning to decay into something other, some other products. And yet, if you go back and do the math here for all of that, they will, get down to the last one. That going at that speed of light with 38 microseconds to live, they should be able to reach 11,000 meters before they decay into something else. And remember, I started out that they are created, they're formed from interactions of stuff from outer space in our upper atmosphere about 6,000 meters up, and yet they should be able to travel 11,000 meters, so you see why they're reaching the Earth's surface at 100, or at least the way we can model it. Gotta be careful with physicists, they argue just like everybody else does, as if it's truth. So it 6,000 compared to 11,000 is the reason why, or at least how our models behave. So that's one way of checking that Einstein was reasonable. Now, as we think some more about space travel now, and particularly, the Hubert Kuster, soon after I came to Elizabethtown College as a young professor, gave me a problem. He said he had done computer iterations and found something about a trip to a nearby star. And anyway, he set it up for me and wanted me to do it analytically from equations. And I couldn't see how to handle this because I knew we were going to have forces that were variable, and that made the integrations to be terrible. So all of a sudden, I was doing a problem for the students in probably modern physics, and all of a sudden the idea came to me that if I just make it a fixed force acting on this spacecraft, and then we could burn the fuel as we want to, but the spacecraft, the person module, that has a fixed weight, and it stays that mass. So if I do that, then the applied force is a constant, and you will see here when we go through that as a work or an illustration, I used 2 times gravity. So in other words, the astronauts had to train before they went off on their trip. They had to train in a setting where they were wearing enough of weights to make them walk around as if they were carrying twice their normal weight. But that seemed to be about the extent of physically what we could prepare an astronaut for. We figured we could double their weight. That they probably, you know, these are healthy people to begin with. So anyway, to do that, that made, I just then plugged it in for the derivative, time derivative of linear momentum, for those of you who care. And then I put in my mass equation there, and then we multiply both sides by dt and integrate from 0 to t on the left, and v1 to v2 on the right. Now, you got that already, don't you? So, now, we'll take, that was from Newton's second law, and here it's set up just to do exactly what I said. And actually, the math is not so bad at this point, just because of that one simplification. And when we do that, we get the bottom equation. And then we move over, and now it looks terrible. But believe it or not, you don't see anything there that's calculus. You don't see anything there that's not algebra. This is the final analytical equation which Hubert Kuster was asking me to come up with. And we have all the parameters that we need there to run through that. And so let's do that and see what we come up with. First of all, let me talk a little bit about some astronomy of our closest stars. Our closest star to us is composed of actually three stars. Does anybody know when you were in... No, your grandkids come home from school and say, "Granny." See, I'm trying to pick on the women here. Let's see. "Granny, I learned today that the closest star to us is..." I'm just seeing. Does anybody remember? The sun, of course. Did some of you start thinking of that? But when we're talking about, we're not usually talking about our sun. So the second closest star to us is actually a group of three stars, and it's called Alpha Centauri. It means it's the brightest star in the Centauri constellation, and it's actually composed of three. It's composed of an A and a B, and Proxima Centauri, which is Alpha Centauri C. It's the one that's, you have the two in here orbiting around each other, and then you have C out here orbiting around those two. They are the closest ones at about 4.37, depending on which one you're talking about, and 4.24 light years from Earth. Now, that varies because this one out here moves so slowly. Right now, it's closest to us, so it has that shorter distance, and I'll talk about light years in a moment, what they are. Another one to that, I don't think we have anybody here who can lay claim to this one. Is there a Barnard here in our group today? No Barnard. Okay, well, Barnard's star is the next closest one out of almost six, pardon me, light years away. And Wolf's star, Wolf 359, is seven, just a little bit over 7 3/4 light years away. So those are, let me get them all here. So now let's take a look at what we might propose here. I'm proposing that we take a trip using Einstein's ideas to a star that's six light years away, or to that vicinity. If you did that, we would catch Alpha Centauri and Barnard's star. So we could potentially catch at least what we see, four stars. We could aim for them. In doing that, the constant force, as I said, was going to be two times our weight. So it's 2g there, and you don't need to worry about that. And we'll accelerate, we'll burn fuel for 1 year. Burn fuel for 1 year. And lo and behold, what do we get? Well, there, when we plug into that humongous equation, which you all don't still believe that it's just algebra, when you plug into that, we're left with everything here. The only variable that's not a constant, g is a constant, c is a constant, and those are numbers. We can just plug them into our computer or into our calculator, whatever. T is the one that we have to plug in for a year in seconds. Lo and behold, when we do all that, whoops, go backwards. When we do that, after 1 year, with a constant force of twice our weight acting on our spacecraft, we're going at 90% of the speed of light. Now, if that doesn't sound, that gets all of my students excited. We can make a trip and we can go at 90% of the speed of light, and all we have to do is accelerate for 1 year. Well, let's take a look at a few things. Yeah, this is exciting. So we'll look at some distances, and first thing we want to do, again, is some simple stuff with a little bit of this here. We have a little bit of calculus. We'll do that here in a moment. Maybe, maybe not. I'll just show you the results. And during this time period, this is during that 1 year of acceleration, we see it on Earth. 1 year has passed by my watch. In their position, and we would have thought they traveled maybe that far, but in fact they haven't. They've traveled 62.6% of one light year is what they have traveled in that time period. And I have a slide here, which I probably should just go through and tell you it's here in case you want to look at it sometime. This shows you all the conversions. Astronomy has all kinds of units from parsecs. We are politically correct. We have parsecs. A little humor. It's down near the bottom. There's a parsec involved. And we also have light years. We have astronomical units, which are the distance between, the average distance between the sun and the earth. And then, of course, we have seconds. Anyway, all these kinds of things we have in units there. And I tried to put a few in there to show the common units which we use, which I still recall the audacity. When I was at Elizabethtown College, we brought an engineer in from a large firm. There's also, there was one down here at Waynesboro. I can't remember, well, it's probably good, I can't remember the name of the firm. It's a big firm that makes switches and things like that for computers. And I asked, because I had a beef, that why we are making our kids suffer through knowing two systems of units. Why don't we teach everybody metric units, which have a logic about them? And I said, now, what units do you do your calculations here at Harrisburg in? Oh, he said, we do them in whatever it was, TORs, or I don't know what all it was that he said. I said, what do the, when you ship it out then, because I knew this, it's an international firm. I said, when you ship it to Brazil to have them then make the part for you, what do they do in it? Oh, well, metric system, of course. I said, so you have them, you just introduced two times to make mistakes into your system. Oh, well, of course, but we're, the essence was, well, we are the big stuff. Anyway, we are not the big stuff. We're part of the global community. And so let's move on to the metric system. I get sermons on all kinds of things here. Okay, let's take now, we did the acceleration. We traveled 0.626 light years during the acceleration period. Here I'm looking at the time that we're coasting in between. First of all, we're going to go back and now figure out the time, not the distance. The time during acceleration, and let me just go through this here quickly. So again, I'm only going to show you the final results, but you can see it's going to be math. It looks like a bunch of algebra again, but you should know everything in there. The only thing that some of you won't know will be natural log, but that you can find on your calculator or ask your grandkids to point it out to you and you could do this calculation. So during the acceleration period, we see them taking a year. In the spacecraft, they see something less than 75% of a year having passed on their watches and their bodies. So all of a sudden, I'm at a different age than my brother who went on the trip. And so now what about during the coasting period? And again, we can do all those calculations. And it turns out that the time period in between would be 6 years from our perspective. But when they do it, did I pass it already? No. Okay. From their perspective in the spacecraft, remember they're traveling at 90% of the speed of light. And so their clocks are really slowed down, including their biological clock. So they have aged, in what I've aged 6 years, they've aged only 1.583 years.
I'll go on the trip.
Now wait, we didn't get to the bad part yet.
Oh. Let's see.
All right. So anyway, here we have a summary of all these things if you want to look at them. To see what time and stuff has gone. It's all done by math. I mean, it's not something I've just guessed at. It fit from Einstein's postulates. So now I want to take a look at what this has to do with our Christian faith. And I'm going to give a few ideas, but I know this could be all, each one of these could be spent a whole sermon on. The first one idea is that human life is sacred, and from Exodus and what we call the Ten Commandments, of course, you shall not murder. And then there's others in Matthew, and Matthew 5 and the Sermon on the Mount, and lots of other places. And my way of a sermon or studying the Bible would be to give the context for these, but I don't have time here this evening to give a context and to try to build it. But that's very important to do for this. This, I'm just sort of proof texting, which I hate to do. Anyway, I want to raise a question here now for a, we can call it an ethical question. If we support a program in which human participants are very likely to lose their lives, is that how God would want us to act? What I haven't showed you the details here, I've just been enamored with the math, and I showed you that. But if you stop and think about the practicality of it, there is on a trip of to cover 6 light years, there's every chance that the spacecraft might have an explosion. There would be a leak. There would be people who would just die because they got sick. Or, as I'll give you a quote here later on from Yuri Gagarin, the first Russian cosmonaut to orbit the Earth. And he said being in a spacecraft with another human being is the perfect situation for murder. So the likelihood that the first one of these we would send out, if we could send it out, that one or more of those astronauts would die is very, very high. And so even just thinking, even if we don't know for sure what that percentage is, as Christians who value life, how do we handle that? That's the question I'm leaving here. And then I leave it with you, giving a little rationale for it, so I sort of speak to the question. Agreeing to cut a person's life short, is that a form of murder? Is this equivalent to not letting persons have as long as possible for the Holy Spirit to talk to them about becoming a Christian? I will show you here in these things. I'm doing a mix in my evaluation. These are all my values. As we go along, several of those, almost everybody, even if they weren't a Christian, would agree with it. Even if people aren't Christians, I would say that almost every religion around the world, I could word the arguments for this one that we just see here about the value of life. Cultures value life. And so that is a strong one that's built in. I just gave you the rationale from it as if we were from the Christian point of view. And then another one is God desires all people to be his children. Now that is again from my Christian perspective, and so I give some references here from 2 Peter and John 3, the one that we all know so much, but I included 16 to 18 and you can read it there. And I leave you with the question here, if there are no Christian believers on a spacecraft which very likely will not return to Earth, have we condemned a person to not know Jesus Christ, to not know the way to Christianity? Well, we could argue that, well, we'll make sure the Gideons get to put a Bible on board. Do you think so? When you're valuing the payload, and now you want to tell the government officials that you want room for a 2-pound Bible yet, I'm not sure that would happen. So we have to stop and think about those things. I didn't leave that on there. Okay, then go to the third one. Seeking human knowledge is not the most important pursuit. And there we have in 1 Corinthians, where Paul is talking in chapter 13 about love, and reminding us that it isn't just what we know from knowledge, and the same thing in Colossians. So I will want to pose the questions here. In which pursuits would God want us to spend our time, money, physical and emotional energy? Is excelling as a scientist, you can put in whatever your vocation was as when you had a, were not retired, is that to be the highest goal in your life? And I'm a strong, I will argue strongly against the idea that I need to excel as a professor because that is what God wants me to do. I would argue God wants me to excel as a person, and that included being a professor, being a father, being a husband, being a churchman. All of that God wanted me to excel at, not just the pursuit of knowledge. Anyway, I'm throwing these out for us to think about, but let's see here. Okay, I have just a bit of time. I'm at four. Jesus taught us to care for the poor and the suffering. And again, there are a lot of references I could have given on this. All I'm doing here is raising the question, will human spaceflight help those who are hungry, homeless, or suffering from war, or not? And I have not heard anybody ever argue that taking a trip to the nearest star helps the hungry. And just to give you some data, the spacecraft, the program to Mars now, I'm not talking now about the taking it to the nearest star, just to Mars. The program to take it to Mars will probably cost us in the neighborhood of $2 trillion. Now, that's a multi-year one. It's supposed to launch in 2035, and it should span over maybe upwards of a decade or five to a decade. Anyway, that's a lot of money and could solve lots of things. Give you a few more things that we could have on problems here. And okay. The problems with crime and violence. I mentioned about, I had the wrong cosmonaut, sorry. It's Valerie Runyon. Ruman? Anybody with Russian background here could help with that. Anyway, he's the one who said, all the conditions necessary for murder are met. If you should have two men in a cabin where they are spending 18 feet by 20 feet and they're letting the time together for 2 months only, he says. There are sexual stresses that would need to be handled somehow. You don't want rape going on up there if you have a mixed, even if you don't have a mixed group. There's loneliness, isolation, communication back has to travel at the speed of light. So it is relatively slow when you're doing that. Now let me just give you a few pieces of information to see another argument of why we don't have to actually face these conditions maybe. We have to think now about energy. A photon engine, and people, my students would get all excited about, well, they had read in this space magazine about photon engines and we're just about ready to have, no, we're not about ready to have one. A photon engine is an engine where it takes matter and it collides matter and antimatter together and it releases energy with no mass left. There is no such craft on drawing boards. Anything we see in our world today always has, almost always has mass left over. There are certain elementary particle reactions which would give just plain energy, but there's no, to bottle them up and put it as an engine to a spacecraft is impossible. So let me just go through that quickly. It wasn't even any math in that one. Now here there'll be a little bit of math. Here we're going to now take a look at a photon engine from conservation of energy. And there you have it. On the left, you have the energy it started with. First is linear momentum it started with. And the photon is on the right of the equal sign. And then the stuff that's left, the F is the fraction of the mass that you started with, which was left. The next one is the similar equations, but it's based on energy. You solve those, and lo and behold, you see the fraction that will be left if you begin. So this is a fraction left. It would be like a percentage of what you started with. And remember, you have to accelerate up, coast to the star, and then accelerate down. And then to come back, you have to do it two more times. So you have to do it four times. So that turns out to be taking, when you plug the numbers actually in for our case, when you do that, the actual number turns out to be 3% of the mass of your rocket, of your spacecraft, you'll have left when you come back. Now, to help you put into perspective, let me give you the conclusion on there. That would take, of the large containers that you go put on a ship today, that amount of energy, if we had a photon engine, which we don't, would require 352 large containers. If we want to go with a conventional engine where we have some exhaust stuff, here again we have linear momentum conservation, energy conserved. So when students, they need to know these. And though we go back to the percentage, now it looks a little messier and we need to be concerned about the velocity. And now I will, When you plug all these in, and this is an amazing rocket engine, the exhaust gases travel at 10% of the speed of light out of the back end. There is no such thing like that, not anywhere near. The closest one we have today, maximum value I tell you there is 1.6 and 10 to the minus 5. That's 0.000016. You can't have this thing. But if we did have this, and I'll show you now without doing all the math, if we had that to do a regular rocket engine, but it's fantastic one where the exhaust gases exhaust at 10% of the speed of light, we would have to have a rocket ship that began with 2,700 Earths as its mass, as its fuel, to be able to do our trip back out and back. I don't think we're going to chew up 2,700 Earths to put into this rocket ship. Finally, we get to look at some other costs here, and I can show you a lot more, but robotic spacecraft, that's what we call these that have rovers on them to Mars. The robotic spacecrafts are much cheaper, at least 10% cheaper than this manned flight to Mars would be. And here is a picture, an artist's picture of what that would be. The top, in case you hadn't seen it down here, this is my artistic block diagram of that spacecraft, which is at the top of there. This rusty thing is remnants from the space shuttle. It's the big fuel tank and the two rockets on either side. So you're seeing the space shuttle reborn again. And we have all those issues we've looked at before. I'll give you one quote here. There was a big study done in 2014 by the National Academies Press. National Academies and the press published it. And their conclusion is, let me see if I can get where I'm at here. Does that say conclusion? There we go. Conclusion was, with so much, even if we had the consensus of all the people in the United States and around the world to work together on this, he still was saying that their report was saying that this is not going to be possible in what they were conceiving, and they were not looking at it from a Christian point of view. And they said only if we put enough effort to it so that the United States could maintain its historical position as leadership in space exploration. I'm just not sure that I want to argue that the United States needs the premier thing for keeping. Here are my conclusions. And there's lots of ones in here. I'll particularly just hone on the last one there. To remind ourselves, our friends, our grandchildren, we have limited numbers of people and their minds. We have limited finances. We have limited time, limited physical resources. So let's spend them on things that may make a difference. I would argue that we should not have a national or international agreement on spacecraft, except not to do it, and to put our efforts into things that would matter. Thank you.
Testing, can you hear me good? Thank you, Richard, for some stimulating things. I'm going to briefly introduce our two respondents. First, Dr. Laura Yorty, who is the Department Chair in Philosophy and Religion, Associate Professor at Bridgewater College. Laura received her PhD from Duke University. She teaches in the fields of environmental ethics, religious ethics, etc. When she's not doing that, she also volunteers to rescue cats. So she has a real interest in cats, and we're glad about that. Our second respondent is also a physics prof type, and that's Daniel King. He is the assistant professor of physics at Eastern Mennonite University. He graduated with a PhD in theoretical and applied mechanics from the University of Illinois. He does a lot of research in acoustics and fluid mechanics. He enjoys playing Ultima, and he teaches mathematics, engineering, physical sciences. These two individuals will come and share their perspectives and responses to Richard's presentation. Following that, we'll take some questions from the audience. Laura?
I'm not used to this kind of mic. If I drop it, then we'll know. Thanks certainly to Richard and Roman for inviting me here. I have not been out here before, so this is fun. It's a very large place. And thank you. I don't think I've read anything with formulas in it in perhaps 40 years. So, if that was a little alien to some of you, it was certainly so to me. But I understood some of it, so good for you.
Thank you.
So Richard raises several questions, and I want to talk a little bit about what he says and then bring up another consideration. He brings up four points: the sacredness of human life, the idea that God desires all people to be God's children, that human knowledge is not the ultimate goal of human life, and that we are called as Christians to care for the poor, the suffering, the lonely, and so forth. These are important considerations. I think they are not, in fact, specific to space travel.
No.
There are considerations for lots of things. So, for instance, the question about the value of human life. Well, presumably, people who go on, if we were doing this space travel and people went on it, they would be volunteers. Let's hope we still have that much democracy. And in fact, I mean, there's a very, very long history of people choosing to take risks for certain goals. And that, I don't think, is, in fact, I'm pretty sure, is not antithetical to Christian faith. I mean, Paul, right? Paul took some risks. He thought the goal was worthwhile. Now, I don't want to equate space travel with, you know, establishing the church. But I don't think you can say simply putting lives at risk is a strong argument against it. Unless we also want to say, well, we shouldn't be climbing Everest, we shouldn't be doing all sorts of other things. Now, let me let you know, I'm not actually going to argue in favor of space travel. I'm just complicating the question.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the second one seems to be more, I wasn't quite sure, but it seems to be more about evangelization. So if we've got people on the spaceship and they're going away forever and they're not coming back, are we somehow prohibiting them from receiving the good news? Is that a fair?
That's fair.
Okay. Well, maybe, although I figure the Holy Spirit's got more ways of, you know, more ways of getting to people certainly than Santa Claus. So, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that making that sort of journey might in fact be just the thing that God designs to bring something, to bring someone to knowledge of God. I mean, the astronauts who've gone up certainly have described their experiences as being transformative in some sort of spiritual sense. The third question about human knowledge not being the ultimate goal of human life, I think is absolutely true. And I think, I mean, we all have to sort of evaluate our vocations in the light of our faith. At least those of us who are privileged enough to be able to make choices, right? Some people don't have those choices, and that's something to keep in mind. And I don't know, I mean, I wonder all the time about my own, you know, am I really doing good in the world teaching these students? Gosh, I don't know. You know, wait 50 years and see. What have they done with their lives? But again, that's not specifically about space travel. I would guess that someone who's an astronaut would need to make those same kinds of considerations as the same way as anyone else. And again, I think it's important to note that choice of vocation or choice of employment is very much a privileged position to be in. The final, the care for the poor and suffering, is crucial, and again applies to everything we do. I mean, budgets are moral documents, right? Budgets declare what we value, what our priorities are. That's partly why we fight so much over them. So I often have this argument in my head that, yeah, why are we going to the moon when we could use that money for the WIC program, for preschool education, for all kinds of things? And we've got sort of biblical arguments to back it up. But you could use the same argument to say, well, why do we have NFL football? Or what's going on now? Hockey. You know, the World Cup, women's soccer, all kinds of other things. Las Vegas. I mean, good Lord, the whole city could, you know. So, and that's a thing, right? I mean, we wrestle with that biblical passage that says, give away everything you have. We don't do it. Some of us get closer than others. But we always have to wrestle with that. And I think maybe part of our job is to keep wrestling with it. I had one professor at Duke who came closer than just about anyone I knew to that. He lived in a very small house. He established a church and a school in Latin America. He clearly lived way below what he could have as a senior professor at Duke. But, you know, we also have conflicting obligations. We're supposed to take care of our families and all the rest of it. So I think those are all important points. But as I said, I don't think they're specific to space travel. So let me shift direction a little bit. Stephen Hawking, physicist. Aren't you proud of me? I'm quoting the scientist here. All right. In several public speeches around 2007, Stephen Hawking called for the establishment of a base on the moon and the eventual colonization of Mars. And he was adamant about this. He was very emphatic. He thought that 25% of the world's resources should be devoted to this endeavor. He thought it was urgent. It was the only way the species would survive, and we ought to get right on it. The reason that Hawking thought this was so urgent is he was pretty sure, he's not alone, that we were going to cause the destruction of human life on Earth pretty soon, either nuclear warfare, climate change, exploding population without enough food resources. We were screwing it up very quickly. And so Hawking's response is, quick, let's run away and start over somewhere new. That is not a Christian response. That's pretty antithetical. There's nothing in his description about penitence, about atonement, about trying to make things right. And there's a curious sort of kind of willful forgetfulness that the people who are going to be on Mars are the same species of the people here. I don't think we have any evidence that we do better in new places. We have a lot of evidence that we do very poorly in new places. I mean, think of all the history of exploration and colonization and all that sort of thing. My sense is, you know, we land on Mars and we'll dig it up and we'll trash it and we'll kill whatever we find there that's living. And then companies will make patents and they'll have fights over it and on and on and on. So that is, I think, a critical issue that is likely, more likely to happen. If space exploration continues. And I don't know what to do about it because a lot of the forces in our culture promote that kind of aggressive, individual, conquering mentality. So that worries me. Maybe we can learn. There's some evidence that we can learn. And I do believe that the Holy Spirit is not stuck on Earth. So I'm hopeful for that too. One side note, I don't know if any of you have read this book. It's one of my favorite books in the world. It's by Mary Doria Russell called The Sparrow. Any of you read that? Oh, it's fabulous. It's about the Jesuits taking a mission to a planet in space. And it's very thoughtfully planned, and it is to help people and to bring them to Christ, and it goes horribly, horribly wrong. But it's really well written. It's interesting because at the end of it, of writing it, she apparently converted to Judaism. So I think the experience of writing it was transformative in a way for her as well.
And I get to quick say something before he comes up here.
Just remember, Hawking was talking about philosophy, and he's not been shown to have expertise and validity necessarily in that. He was not talking as a physicist, just to keep that straight.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah, thanks, Richard, for your talk. This was very interesting. To me, as a physicist, I'm going to keep my comments mostly to that side of things, because quite frankly, I feel a lot more comfortable talking about the physics side of things than perhaps the philosophy and some of those things. So I'm glad that someone else was here to talk about that other stuff. It seems one of the arguments that you made against this is about the sort of this cost-benefit framework, right? We're weighing the costs and benefits in all this. And I think that's a totally valid thing to do. I mean, obviously, we're all going to weigh these things very differently. And so I just wanted to bring up a couple of points that maybe change the weighting of those. The maybe the benefits are higher than we think, and maybe the costs are lower than we think for something like this. One of them has to do with the eventual benefits of attempting to tackle a challenging goal or doing basic research in science. These eventual benefits, I think, are very hard to anticipate and hard to factor into any sort of analysis. The moon mission happened around the time of the development of computers, digital computers, right? And these things sort of drove each other forward. And CERN, the big particle accelerator, particle detectors, was instrumental in the formation of the internet, which is just, you know, a tremendous advancement. Recently, and these two things together allow me to talk to my one-year-old nephew in Alaska today, you know, like right now, and that's pretty amazing. And you know, CERN and the moon mission had nothing to do with that, but these are side benefits that come along when we, as a species, tackle challenging goals. So I think we should keep that in mind. A second point is that related to the costs is that the resource costs are also hard to anticipate because a creative engineering approach can sometimes sidestep what we think are fundamental limits when we're going towards a goal. So this was actually a story I heard yesterday. Again, I'm going to keep bringing up the moon landing because that's maybe the closest analog we have. But apparently NASA's original plan was to send a rocket all the way to the moon and land this rocket on the moon and then launch it back off and send it back. And there was an engineer in NASA who argued very strongly against this, saying for the exact same reason that the fuel costs to send something that far is just way too great. There's no way you can do this. And he proposed a different approach, that maybe we should create a much lighter module, a landing module that can just ferry our astronauts down, up and down. And we need to solve a different problem. We need to solve a problem of how do we dock in space. But we have a different fundamental limit than that we're tackling. So for these interstellar travels, you know, one different approach might be to not take all that fuel. Stephen Hawking has proposed this before he died 5 years ago or so, that maybe we use lasers and we use radiation power. We shine these lasers on something and use that propulsion, and then you can generate all this stuff on the Earth and you're not carrying so much weight. And so maybe, I don't know. I mean, this is obviously not feasible in our lifetime, my lifetime, my kid's lifetime. This is a long way off, but maybe that limitation is not actually there with a creative approach. The third point is about the monetary costs, and the question is, are they actually that large? There is, certainly for interstellar travel, that's immensely expensive, travel within the solar system, maybe say to Mars, right? it's very difficult. The moon takes days to get to. The Mars takes, going to Mars would take months to get to. Going to the stars would take generations to get to, right? That's the sort of the scale of these things. But if the mission to the to Mars, and I've seen a range of values, but maybe 100 billion is one estimate. So you said, I think, a couple trillion. There's also estimates on the low end, like 10 billion or something like that.
For one trip,
right,
this
right, right.
This is a program.
Right. But if we take that 100 billion cost and spread that over a 20-year period, which is probably the time frame we're looking at about 5 billion a year. And 5 billion a year is a lot more money than I have, and a lot more money than any of you have, I'm guessing. But in comparison to even just the United States budget, the spending that the United States does, that's $4 trillion. We're talking 1/1000th, we're talking 0.1%. If you make $50,000 a year, that's $50. Would you pay $50 to go to Mars? $50 a year for 20 years. So these costs are all relative, and yes, it will fund the food stamp program for a long time. On the other hand, it will not fund the defense budget for a long time, right? So maybe we don't need to pit these things against each other. And so then I guess maybe the very final thing I'll say, is that this perceived benefit and this idea that caring for the poor and ending suffering is a possibility. If we don't do space travel, or if we don't do something, then we can do this other thing. And I think that's maybe doesn't hold, at least in my mind, because quite frankly, science is easy and society is hard, right? science, there's a cause and an effect, right? We can build a model and we can understand this, but humans and health and education, society, that's all fuzzy. And I can't just like focus on this issue and I'm gonna solve it. And even if I can solve it, I can't convince everyone else to then. This is messy stuff. So anyway, just a couple of thoughts about cost and benefit when we're thinking about these things. But thanks very much for stimulating this discussion here.
Okay, I'll ask Laura and Daniel to have a seat at the table. Testing 1, 2, 3. So Richard, you can use that mic and you too can pass that around. Okay, this is your time to ask questions. I'll make very short comments if you wish. And you may direct your question to anyone on the panel or all three. And we're going to start over here and see if there are any questions, then I'll move there. One thing I do ask is that you identify yourself, say who you are, before you ask the question. Anyone here have a question? Yes.
I think this is directed to Richard. Do we learn anything by looking back? And the example I would give is Magellan, when he thought he could go around the world, and he left home with 250 men, 5 ships, and they limped back 2.5 years later with 18 men and I believe one ship, and not including Magellan, who was killed along the way. So that involved resources and risk and uncertainty and hubris and all the things that we're talking about now. So do we learn anything from that? I have one side question, quick side question. Jesus said, I have worlds that you know not of. Does that refer to space beings?
The last thing is easier. That's actually another talk that I would like to give sometime, to talk about exoplanet exploration and what happens if there are intelligent life on other planets, what happens to salvation and stuff. That's interesting. The other point that's been raised here, I am concerned about history. And I actually, Laura, I enjoyed your comment that my faith things were not peculiar to space travel, because that is my life. And so I was bringing my values out and saying, here, I'm applying them here. Well, later on, I'll apply them over here. But the other point, the first one that you began with about history, I do remember, I mean, to me, and I maybe didn't state that question well, that I raised when I asked about people dying and what are we involved with. And that question is, if we facilitate the occurrence of something, are we guilty? And I think there has been lots of stuff dealing with Jewish stuff during the Holocaust to say that we are. And that's my concern is.
Do either of the other panelists have a comment you want to make? Question in the middle?
My name is Vic Berger. I'm in Park Place. I have a question about the statement you said, when we put people's lives at risk, is it worth it? If we go back to Henry Ford, when he invented an automobile that goes 17 miles an hour, was that worth it? When I get into my car, there's a chance I may not exist. Is it worth it?
Okay, someone want to take a stab at that? Respond.
Well, I will only raise this. We all think, well, no, we don't do this to other people. But the American Physical Society, the premier physical society internationally, I'm not bragging, that's just the way it is, has repented of ever introducing the world to the nuclear bomb. Because we realize that by our applying this, we've opened Pandora's box in a way that never was meant to have been opened. So there are cases that we can review that.
There was a question back here, yes.
I'm Mary Ruth Shutters. I live in Park Place. I wonder if any of you would comment on the development of artificial intelligence.
Okay, Daniel, I think it's your turn.
What would you like me to comment on related to that? It's a very big topic.
Yeah. Well, I've read quite a bit about it. Some things could be good, some things could be very bad as time goes on, because these artificial intelligence can be programmed to do things that might be detrimental to our way of living.
While you're thinking, maybe Laura has a comment. You've got him stumped, but...
Well, I mean, that's sort of been a fear of lots of technology. I think that's always the question. I mean, it is basically the same question as sort of nuclear energy. We develop things, and it tends to be, well, we can figure this out, and we do it, and then we start thinking about, well, was that a good thing or a bad thing?
A lot of inventors, engineers, scientists will say that technology is agnostic. It can be used for good or for bad, and that depends on the hands of the people that apply this. I think I agree with that, but I'm not totally sure. I'll be honest. I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I mean, historically, technology has brought us great things, and it's also caused great harm. Both of those things happen together, and they come together. I think artificial intelligence is another step in that path. Yeah.
Question here.
I'm Angie Williams from Park Gables. Having worked as an assistant to the director of astronautics in the Air and Space Museum at the time that man first landed on the moon. It gives me a certain interest and maybe perspective. First, I want to tell you, I was actually in a lunar module, but it was in the Smithsonian Institution. I never left Earth in it. I also handled some spacesuits and knew some astronauts there. However, one of the arguments in favor of it, because I myself had some questions about it at different times, but one of the arguments in favor of the space exploration had to do with technological advances in medicine. And I don't even recall what those were. Does anyone know what they were?
Some of it at least had to do with monitoring. We learned way new things about how to monitor people at a distance, but I don't know what else.
Okay, question here. Okay, there's one in the back. Then there'll be a question over here, I hope. Just a minute.
Larry Clark from Park Gables. I hear myself thinking on how God might be thinking right now, and my suspicion is that since God created us in God's image, that God created us with a curiosity that can't be stamped out, and we're almost compelled to try to discover new things and try to think new things.
Yeah, but I would argue He doesn't propel us to one, but does He propel us to space travel, or does He, would He say, apply it to solving the homeless problem?
Okay, question or comment here? Oh, did you all have something else? Another question in the middle. Okay, we have one here, then one back there.
Just one other thought. Have you heard of the space-time continuum and Einstein's theory of bending space? In other words, we can't go millions of miles or parsecs this way, but if we can fold it in, we can just jump over.
And this is a thing that where our observations match the theory, as we would say. Space is curved due to gravity. If we wanted to use this to bend space ourselves to travel to distant stars, the energy requirements are significantly higher than any sort of traveling like that. And so the amount of mass that you need to fold space in. Now, there are some that will say that wormholes, these like jumps between, so the idea of a wormhole, right, is you have a space and you can't get from one side of the page to the other, but if you could fold the page and jump through that way, right, then you could travel these vast distances. But we have no real evidence that they exist. Yeah, I don't know where to go beyond that.
Question here.
I'm Liz Lawson, and I'm curious about why the Chinese landed on the other side of the moon. Do you all know? Okay. Maybe you three can comment on that.
I do know. The other side, in its gross features, it's similar to this side. In its medium to smaller features, it's dramatically different. So I think it was purely trying to find more and looking to see what's there in terms of mining. That's a big thing about the moon.
And I think also just to the technical challenge of doing that is also another reason they would have attempted such a mission. It's never been done before. Let's see what we can do.
We have just a few minutes remaining. Anyone else have a question? Okay, there's one over here.
In the early 60s, they were talking about a man to the moon, and I had a man come to me on the streets of Lancaster and say, it will never happen, because the Bible says, heaven is the dwelling place of God, and the earth has been given to man. It'll never happen. Well, it surely did.
Any reflections on that?
Go
Well, the Bible doesn't say that.
Okay, what is it?
I mean,
it says, I'm not the Hebrew scholar.
I think, yes, I know you aren't, John, you weren't putting that forth as this, you believe that, but that, no, the number of people proposed all kinds of things about why it wouldn't happen. We went to Belize in 70. Talk about not believing, they were sure it was photographed in Arizona desert somewhere. There was never, never any person on the moon. But anyway, I think you read the fine firmament, the King James, there's all, you have to redefine some of those in our current understanding. And I think God gave the universe to us. That's my view. Anyway, that's just an idea.
Okay, I think we'll draw this to a close. I want to thank each of you for coming and invite you to consider attending the rest of our elder exchanges as the months to come. If you filled out an evaluation form, I invite you to leave it on the table. If you haven't filled it out, take it along home and please send it to us. As a benediction sending away, I just thought of this little hymn that